If a president can disappear, think how easy it would be for a vice president to vanish. Permanently. Get your shit together. This is the last time I'm going to warn you.
Snyder stood and said to Rolander, "Let's go." 15 minutes later, with the privacy screen raised and knowing Snyder had his limousine swept continually for bugs, Rolander felt safe to speak.
"I'm worried about Marshfield."
"There's nothing to worry about," said Snyder.
"Nothing to worry about? The man's falling apart."
"He'll be fine. Besides, he knows what will happen to him if he tries to unburden his soul. I've got a pair of eyes on him at all times."
"How deep does this thing go?"
"Deep enough to make it work. Right now, Marshfield is the least of our worries. I never should have let you talk me into concocting that plot to set up Harvath."
"There wasn't enough time to sit around and think. At the time, it made perfect sense. Killing him would have been too suspicious. Framing him solved a lot of problems in one tidy little package."
"And then it created a whole hell of a lot more. We should have terminated him in his apartment when we had the chance."
"Listen, David, there's no use crying over spilt milk. He's on the lam, and all that stunt has done is cemented Washington's belief that he's guilty."
"But he knows too much."
"Not enough. It's all circumstantial. The rantings of a nut who has suffered severe head trauma. It will never stick."
"He's managed to kill two of my best contract agents outside the bank and seriously wound three others between there and the Union Station fiasco. Harvath is not someone I'm going to underestimate again."
"From what you've told me, the two he killed were lucky shots. The other guys, especially the one that got his arm torn out of his socket, deserve what they got for being stupid. They knew full well what kind of background Harvath has. To try and take him up close was a mistake. One which I'm sure your people won't make again."
"No, they won't."
"Fine. Now, what about that ransom note Marshfield received?"
"What about it?"
"What are we going to do?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing? What do you mean, nothing?"
"I mean just that. I've already been through this potential scenario with Fawcett. He thought this might happen, especially considering how much money he's already paid out. It was a natural to expect our lions to get greedy. His decision was we do nothing."
"But how can we do that?"
"Simple. If the president doesn't return alive, then Marshfield remains in the number one position to finish out Rutledge's term. A couple more well-orchestrated high-profile events while he runs down the clock for the former president, and he's a shoo-in to get reelected. Then he has the potential to serve for 2 full terms, and we'll own him all the way. It makes a lot of sense, really. We can't lose."
"Except there's a fly buzzing around that might land in the ointment."
"Who? Harvath? For Christ's sake, Russ. One minute you tell me not to worry about him, and the next you're painting him as the one thing that could bring everything crashing down around us. You think I'm going to let that happen? I already have a lead on him."
"You do?"
"Surprised? You think being on the Senate Intelligence Committee doesn't have a couple of advantages? Apparently, Harvath called Lawler at the FBI yesterday, proclaiming his innocence. Ever the thorough G-man, Lawler put a trace on the call and found it was coming from a payphone at the Ritz. By the time his guys got there, no one fitting Harvath's description could be found, so they did the usual, questioned a bunch of staff and potential witnesses, took statements, and left."
"So they didn't nab him. What's that got to do with our problem?"
"It has everything to do with our problem. When the FBI questioned people and they said they never saw Harvath there, they were telling the truth."
"Okay, but I don't follow you."
"The FBI made the same mistake with Harvath that we did. They underestimated him. Do you actually think with half of D.C. looking for him, he'd be wandering around without some sort of disguise?"
Senator Rolander's eyebrows arched up.
"It makes sense, doesn't it?" continued Snyder. "The Ritz is one of the city's most security-conscious hotels. They have cameras everywhere. Based on the timing of the phone call to Lawler and which bank of phones it came from, it was just a matter of rolling back the videotapes, and we had him. We also had an outside camera showing him getting into a cab. The doorman remembered that he spoke English with a German-sounding accent. We got the number of the cab and showed the picture to the driver, who said he took him to Union Station. So he hopped on a train, but where to? Asked Rolander.
He didn't hop on any train. He switched cabs at Union Station, and probably three or more times before he got to Dulles.
Dulles? What airline?
Swiss Air. We got a hold of the airport security tapes and quietly passed his picture around. He traveled under the name of Hans Brauner and flew to Zurich last night.
Are you sure?
Yes, I saw the video myself. He was still wearing the same disguise from the Ritz.
But Switzerland? Jesus, how did he figure out the Switzerland connection? Said Rolander, his voice taut.
I have no idea. It must have something to do with Andre Martin, and maybe that envelope Harvath was seen taking out of the locker at the train station.
I knew this was going to happen. You're right. We underestimated him. Shit. What are we going to do?
Rolander was sweating, but Snyder was as calm as ever. I've already set the wheels in motion.
What does that mean?
I sent a team over to silence Agent Harvath once and for all.
But he could be anywhere. How are you going to find him?
Quietly, I flagged his passport and put both his name and the pseudonym Hans Brauner on the Swiss watch list. I've got someone manning a bogus State Department phone line and email address. The directive I sent was not to try and apprehend him, only to keep him under surveillance and notify us if he shows up.
If he shows up?
Don't worry. He will.
I think we should let our lion know what's happening.
Why?
What if Harvath tracks them down?
What if he does? He wouldn't stand a chance against them.
I thought we weren't going to underestimate Agent Harvath anymore.
Exasperated at having to spell everything out for his fellow senator, Snyder took a deep breath before drawing the picture. First of all, the only way I have to get in touch with them is via the post office box. It was set up that way to protect all of us. Secondly, they're trying to screw us right now by asking for more money. If we tip them off about Harvath, they might figure out a way to use him against us. It's better that we stay quiet about it. He'll pop his head up at some point, and we'll be there to nail him. Don't worry. Besides, even if Harvath did locate the lion's den, which I don't think he has a snowball's chance in hell of doing, he's no match for these guys. They'll rip him apart. And that's not an underestimation.
But what about the president's finger? Even you've got to admit that's going too far. What if they kill him?
If they do, then that's just the cost of doing business.
51. Harvath hated jet lag. Even though he had slept for most of the plane ride and had forced himself to stay up late last night, he still woke up early this morning. Opening his eyes, he could see that it was dark, and the only indication that anyone was up at this hour was the occasional sound of traffic from the nearby street. He closed his eyes again and tried to force himself back to sleep, but soon realized he was up for good. The bare wood was cold under his feet. Quietly, he padded down the hall to the bathroom and then returned to his room. Scott began a slow routine of stretching, testing his muscles. Although the bruises would probably take weeks to disappear, at least the stiffness was dissipating. He chalked up his returning muscle function and mobility to the shape he'd been in before the avalanche. As he continued stretching, moving into a series of yoga postures, concentrating on his breathing, he noticed his head was still aching. From the yoga, he moved into a series of push-ups, crunches, and dips, using the footboard of the bed and a chair. Covered in a light film of sweat, breathing heavily and with a somewhat queasy stomach, Harvath grabbed his towel, toiletry kit, and a stack of coins and headed off for the shower. When he returned, he had a breakfast of bread, cheese, and fruit, and two Tylenols, followed by a cup of strong black coffee. After brushing his teeth, he dressed in another, "Hey, dude," snowboarder outfit, tucked the Glock into his waistband, put his jacket on, and crept from the hostel. When the post office opened, Harvath was standing at the main doors with a USA Today newspaper tucked beneath his arm. As he walked up to the window marked Post Restant, Scott noticed that the same woman was behind the counter as yesterday, when he'd been buying envelopes and stamps.
"Good morning," he said in English,
knowing the woman was fluent.
Ah, good morning, sir. Here to see if we have received your letter yet?
Yes, I hope it's here. I need the money to buy my train ticket to Strasbourg.
I will check for you. What is the name again, please?
Harvath had not wanted to give the woman his real name yesterday, and so he had used the first one that popped into his head.
Sampras, Pete Sampras.
He knew it was a stupid choice, but once the name had crossed his lips, he couldn't pull it back.
Of course, like the tennis player, she said.
Yeah, except he plays tennis better than I do, and has a lot more money.
Well, maybe we can change that. The money part, I mean, she said with a smile,
writing down his name and walking to the back. Yesterday, Harbath had completely cased the post office after his plan had come to him. Standing outside, he would never be able to tell if Aunt Jane or someone working for her had accessed the post office box. The only way he would be able to surveil it was from inside. But how could he sit around inside the post office all day without attracting suspicion? He remembered a con game he had seen in a movie called House of Cards and decided a spin on it might work. Post offices worldwide would accept mail for you, even if you didn't have a box with them, as long as the letter was addressed to you at the post office with the words Poste Restante. All you had to do was keep checking in for your mail, and when a piece arrived for you, show your passport and claim it. It was very simple. The clerk came back, shaking her head.
I'm sorry, Mr. Sampras. We still have no mail for you.
Darn it. I was hoping to catch a morning train.
You can check back later if you like. We have mail arriving all day here.
That's very nice of you.
You know, if it's not too much trouble, it is very cold outside this morning, and I don't even have enough money to have breakfast. Would it be okay if I just sat over there and waited?
I'm sure it'll be here at some point today.
Harbath was pushing it. The idea of him sitting in the post office all day might not appeal to the clerk, but he had put just enough flirt into his dialogue with her that he felt she would say yes.
I don't think it would be a problem, she smiled. I will keep your name here, and next time I go to the back, I will check again. Maybe I'll even bring you a coffee.
Thanks. I have my newspaper. And I will just be sitting over there.
Very well. Next customer, please.
Scott made his way over to the wooden bench and sat down, making himself as comfortable as possible. This could be a very long wait. There was no telling how often Aunt Jane's post office box got checked, if at all. For all Scott knew, the mail might get forwarded someplace else entirely. He positioned himself and the paper at such an angle that he could see the box. But to anyone looking in his direction, it would appear as if he were engrossed in his paper. 10 o'clock came and went. The friendly clerk called him back over to her counter and handed him a cup of coffee, apologizing that his letter was still not there. He sat back down on the bench and waited. At 10:20, a group of elderly people entered the post office en masse. Apparently, they all liked to hike down to the post office and do their business together. Several went to post office boxes, and for a moment, Scott had trouble telling if the slight figure in the blue quilted jacket and brown hat was opening the box he had been watching. The group of septuagenarians milled about in front of him, blocking his view. Through a brief opening in the crowd, he saw a gloved hand close and lock a box. His box. Aunt Jane, or someone connected to her, had opened the box and retrieved the letter. He had purposely purchased a brightly colored envelope yesterday and could tell, even from where he sat, that the one in the gloved hand was his. The throng of elderly Swiss moved toward him as they prepared to get into the stamp line. He politely pushed his way through the tangle of walking sticks, hiking boots, and lederhosen. Outside on the concrete steps of the post office, Scott looked quickly to his left and caught a glimpse of a blue coat and brown cap turning the corner. He took off after it, slowing only when he got to the intersection. A person of average height and slim build was walking just ahead of him, seemingly unaware of being followed. Harbath followed, and hadn't made it 15 feet when the figure crossed the street and looked into a pastry shop window. He knew what the person was doing. It was the same maneuver he had used on many occasions, checking the reflection in the glass to see if anyone was following. He had no choice but to look straight ahead and to continue down the block.
Luckily, streets in Interlaken, for the most part, were small and provided ample opportunities for ducking off. The first chance Harvath got, that's exactly what he did. Since the person he was following had been proceeding in this direction, and Harvath was confident he hadn't been noticed, he hid himself in a doorway and waited for him to walk by. Hopefully, his wait wouldn't be in vain. 5 minutes passed, then 10, then 15. Nothing. Harvath had lost him. He was certain of it. Whoever he was following either had gotten spooked and doubled back, or had never intended to take this route anyway. He was angry with himself for losing his quarry. Now he would have to show up for the meeting tomorrow blind, with no idea of whom to look for. That was extremely dangerous. But once more, he had no choice. The place he had set for the meeting was known as the Jungfraujoch, the top of Europe. It was a tourist attraction carved into a glacier on the Jungfrau Mountain. The Jungfrau stood right next to the Eiger. The Jungfraujoch was a dangerous place in which to hold a clandestine meeting, but it was one of the few locations close to Interlaken that Scott felt he knew well enough and would feel safe in. The crowds of tourists would provide ample cover. It was next to impossible for a sniper to set up anywhere, and there was only one way into the Jungfraujoch, by train. Scott planned to have all of his bases covered. As he stepped out of his hiding spot and turned up a different street to make his way back to the hotel, a pair of steely eyes in another doorway stared out from beneath the brim of a brown cap and memorized every feature of his face. The only thing that prevented Harvath from being followed was his watcher's need to discover what was inside the brightly colored envelope and return it to the post office box before its rightful owner arrived to claim it. 52.
Hey there! Where's your board?
The voice caught Harvath completely off guard. He turned to see the group of noisy Americans he had encountered 2 days ago walking toward him on the platform. Leading the pack was the cute girl with the nose ring.
You didn't forget it, did you? She asked.
Nope. My friends never showed up, so I'm going to have to rent my gear, Harvath replied.
Bummer. We're heading up to Vengen. You're welcome to board with us.
Thanks. I really appreciate it, but I bought this good morning ticket thing so I'd get a cheap deal up to the Jungfraujoch.
We did that yesterday. We took the 6:35 a.m. train. Boy, was that early. But we saved a few francs that way.
Harvath made small talk with the group until the older greenish-gray Berner Oberlandbahnen train pulled into the station. The train had 11 cars, the front half of which would go toward Lauterbrunnen, while the back half would go toward Grindelwald. As Harvath was going to take the Grindelwald route to get to the Jungfraujoch, he said goodbye to everyone and hopped on one of the cars in back. At precisely 7:35, the train pulled out of the station and made its way toward the first stop of Wilderswil. The steep mountain seemed to begin right at the tracks and shoot straight up. Even at this time of year, the mountains gave forth with the bright hues of evergreen trees, which were made even more brilliant by the contrast of the pure white snow. As beautiful as the rugged alpine scenery was now, Scott knew it was nothing compared to what this region was like in spring. That was how he'd first experienced Interlaken and the Jungfrau region. Mountains overflowing with a myriad of colors from all the blooming wildflowers. On the Schöniger Platte alone, up and to the left of where the train was now, there were over 500 different types of plant life visible in the spring. The waterfalls and rivers tumbled and roared into the valleys below, fed by glacier water and melting snow from high above on the surrounding peaks. As Scott continued to watch the scenery, he had to admit to himself that there really wasn't a bad time of year to visit Switzerland. At Zweiluchenen, the back half of the train was joined to a new engine, which picked up speed and headed east toward Grindelwald. Looking out the window on the right side of the train, Scott got his first glimpse of Switzerland's famous trio of mountains, the Eiger, the Munch, and his destination, the Jungfrau. The mountains packed with ice and snow were beautiful and terrifying at the same time. When he'd first visited the Jungfrau region, he had purchased a book called The White Spider, about several of the earliest attempts to scale the Eiger. As he looked out the window, he tried to pick out the area known as Death Bivouac, but the combination of distance and the heavy snow covering made it too difficult. As the creaky old train rolled and squealed its way up the mountain, Harvath consulted his schedule. It was 8:03, and the train was pulling into Schwendi. One more stop, and they would be in Grindelwald. 6 minutes later on the dot, the quaint village, bathed in early morning light, rose directly up in front of them. Its glitzy shops and sports stores were all modestly housed in beautiful traditional Swiss chalets of varying shapes, sizes, and colors. Early rising Europeans garbed in brightly colored outfits clunked along the streets in heavy ski boots, with skis slung casually over one shoulder. It reminded him of Park City. Scott envied them their carefree strides and the ease of the day that faced them. Where to ski followed only by where to eat. He, on the other hand, had no such luck in predicting what the day would bring. His plan was to get up to the Jungfraujoch early and scout things out. While he could have taken the 6:35 train from Interlaken, he'd worried about being there too early and not having any crowds he could blend in with. Judging from the number of passengers on his train, he had made the right choice. A nice Saturday tourist throng would provide cover and help keep him safe. It would also be easy to disappear into, if it came to that. At Grindelwald, passengers were required to transfer to a cogwheel railway. The view of the Eiger from the station was incredible. Scott had seen some pretty crazy things in his time, but he never understood why anyone would willingly choose to climb a mountain, especially one like the Eiger. Harvath took a last look back at the Hotel Derby and Grand Hotel Regina, which flanked the Grindelwald train station, as he crossed the platform toward the cogwheel train. It was composed entirely of second-class cars, divided into smoking and non-smoking sections. Noticing that the passengers were predominantly European and Japanese, he knew that the biggest crowd would be found in the smoking car and grudgingly climbed aboard. The honey-colored wooden seats were uncomfortable, but the incredible view of the snow-covered mountains made up for it in spades. The cogwheel railway wove slowly in and out between houses and small farms on the outskirts of Grindelwald. As they drew even with the face of the Eiger, the train stopped at the Grindelwald Grund, Grindelwald's second station, whose parking lot was filled with tour buses. The good morning ticket seemed to have a lot of cost-conscious fans. As new passengers boarded, all of the remaining seats were quickly taken. Smoke filled the compartment, and Harvath was happy no one complained when he reached up for the two knobs embedded in the glass window and pulled it down a fraction to let in some fresh air. A Japanese man, sensing Scott was not a smoker, laughed and offered him a cigarette. The train picked up speed, and the chalets grew farther and farther apart. Harvath knew from experience that in the spring and summer, the fields they were now passing would be filled with a chorus of ringing bells, hanging from the necks of grazing sheep, goats, and cows. Each group of bells had a different tone, so the farmer could recognize his own livestock, even in dense fog. At Kleine Scheidegg, passengers changed to the final train that would take them all the way to the top of the Jungfrau. The red crushed velour seats were a welcome respite from the wooden ones of the previous train. Harvath remained with his group of European and Japanese smokers, who were upset to find that for the rest of the ride there would be no smoking. For this leg of the journey, Scott and his fellow passengers were traveling completely inside the mountain. At 9,400 feet above sea level, the train stopped for 5 minutes at the Eigervon station, where windows had been carved out of the rock face so passengers could look out onto Kleine Scheidegg and the Grindelwald Valley far below. The next stop was for another 5 cold minutes to overlook the glacier at the Icemere station, 10,368 feet above sea level. Harvath filed off the train and pretended to absorb the breathtaking views with the rest of the passengers. Back on board, his heart began to beat faster, and he felt moisture forming on his palms. He leaned back in his seat, somewhat reassured by the sharp stab of the plastic Glock in his waistband. Only moments after the train began moving, the overhead speaker began playing another tape-recorded message. It came as the others had, first in German, then French, followed by Italian, Spanish, and finally English.
This is Jungfraujoch, the highest railway station in Europe, 3,354 meters above sea level. Please follow the direction signs to observation points and the restaurants. Thank you for your visit, and we wish you a pleasant stay on the Jungfraujoch.
Pleasant stay. As the train came into the final station and the doors opened, Harvath knew there wasn't much chance of that.
53. Harvath looked at his watch. It was exactly 9:53 a.m. The Swiss were amazingly precise. Not one of the trains he had been on in the last 3 days had wavered 1 minute from its timetable. He had just over 2 hours to survey the area and get ready for his meeting with dear Aunt Jane. Harvath didn't waste time. From the station, he measured how long it took him to get to the ice palace. 30 meters deep within the glacier, it was a horseshoe-shaped tunnel carved completely out of the ice. Even the floor was ice. The Europeans didn't have the healthy fear of lawsuits that the Americans did. Getting any traction on the floor was next to impossible. The best one could do was a shuffle that mimicked ice skating. He continued on to the outdoor plateau, then back inside to check the restrooms, shops, restaurants, and the exhibition hall. He passed the blue coin-operated luggage lockers and made his way up the long hallway to the Eiger climbing wall and the computers that let you send free emails from the top of Europe. He was tempted, but decided against it. Taking the fastest elevator in Switzerland, he arrived at the Sphinx observation area and weather station. After a good look around, he descended in the elevator and headed outside to the adventure area with its dog sled rides, tobogganing, skiing, and snowboarding. The slopes were already packed. The fact that almost the entire complex was buried deep within the icy mountain gave Scott an odd feeling of déjà vu. His mind wandered to being caught in the avalanche with Amanda. As quickly as the thought came up, Scott slammed shut an iron door to that part of himself and focused on the job at hand. He suspected Aunt Jane and her people would show up on the 10:53 train, if they hadn't come on the 9:53 with him or arrived even earlier on the 8:53. He felt certain that they would not be coming on the one that arrived at 7 minutes before noon. That would be cutting it too close, and would not give them enough time to case the area and make sure it wasn't a trap. Scott kept his eyes open the entire time he was surveying the Jungfraujoch. He looked for that same blue quilted coat and brown cap, or any man that might be of the same build. He soon found that style of jacket to be quite popular with the Europeans, and was frustrated on 3 different occasions when he thought he had spotted his prey. For his part, he kept his wool cap pulled tight around his ears and the collar of his coat turned up. He glanced at the exhibits, picked up postcards, and looked for souvenirs, while marking in his memory each nook, cranny, crevice, and exit door that could hide an enemy or provide a means of escape for him if necessary. One of the biggest advantages the Jungfraujoch had presented when he was considering it for his meeting was also its biggest disadvantage. There was only one way in or out. By train. Scott began to realize how stupid he might have been. Whether his head was still scrambled or he had just been too desperate to think of something else, he was quickly beginning to realize that this was not one of his all-time greatest plans. Control of the situation was everything. If he lost control, things would go very bad very fast. As 12 o'clock grew near, Scott's hopes of swarms of tourists to use as camouflage began to diminish, as many of them headed off to the restaurants for lunch. A few stragglers were still roaming about, and there were the people who probably got off the 11:53 train to look forward to, but he didn't hold out much hope for the cover he had counted on. His nerves began to crackle, and adrenaline coursed through his body as he walked down the snowy path toward one of the entrances to the ice palace. He figured they would expect him to enter from the main door off the elevator from the train station, and therefore chose a completely different approach. He stood outside, waiting for the right moment to start walking, having timed to the second how long it would take him to reach the halfway point. As soon as he entered the mouth of the ice palace, the wind that had been whipping around his face outside immediately dropped off. He walked ahead slowly, ever aware of the slick floor beneath his boots. One hand gripped the railing as his other hand remained in his right coat pocket, where he'd transferred the Glock. Pretending to admire the sculptures carved out of the sheer ice walls, he moved from niche to niche, as if he were following the stations of the cross in an old cathedral. He was no longer picking up his feet, but rather shuffling them along the ice, getting a feel for the movement. Up ahead, the corridor turned to the right and obstructed his view. He kept up his pace, shuffled to a sculpture, stand for a moment to appreciate it, and then shuffled to the next. He listened intently for any other sounds coming from within the cavern of ice, but heard nothing. A wisp of a voice, from behind the iron door he had clamped down on his mind, asked him how he would know whom he was looking for and what he would do when he found them. Scott pushed the thought away and focused his energy. He would know whom he was looking for. He would be able to tell by looking in their eyes. People accustomed to killing had a very distinct look and bearing about them, just like the men at Union Station who had tried to kill him on Wednesday. He rounded the bend in the corridor, a gust of circulating air biting at his earlobes. Before he had come in, he had removed his hat, thinking his odd appearance might fool the people he was after, and thereby give him a slight advantage. The bend behind him, Harvath now was looking at a sculpture of a large bear with a salmon captured in its jaws. Another gust of ventilation wind blew through the corridor, which glowed an eerie blue from the ice. As Harvath prepared to move along to the next sculpture, he felt a hard jab in his back and heard a woman's voice. She spoke in English, but with a Swiss accent.
"We are quite fond of bears in Switzerland. It's a lovely sculpture, isn't it, Mr. Sampras? Or, should I say, Mr. Harvath?"
"Son of a bitch," Scott mumbled to himself.
He was taken completely by surprise. He hadn't heard her sneak up. She must have been behind one of the sculptures, waiting for him to pass before coming after him. His body tensed, ready to strike. She could feel it.
"Relax, Mr. Harvath. This is a gun I have at your back."
"You don't say. And I thought you were just happy to see me."
"I am not amused, Mr. Harvath. Please take your hand out of your pocket, slowly."
Scott did as he was told.
"How do you know my name?"
"That is not important. What is important is your interest in—"
At once, the woman's sentence was interrupted by flying pieces of ice. At first it seemed as if the statue were falling apart. But as the trajectory of the chips began changing, Scott knew all too well what was going on. Someone was shooting at them with a silenced weapon from the bend in the hallway, and they were closing fast. The woman behind Harvath was equally distracted by the flying ice chips, quickly coming to the same conclusion he had. Without wasting a moment more, Scott drove his right elbow down hard into her stomach. He heard her gun clatter onto the ice. With a moan, she fell backward. Scott spun, intending to pick up her weapon, but it slid in the direction of the approaching shooter, and he would have had to climb over the woman to get to it. His eyes locked on her face for a brief moment.
"She is amazingly beautiful,"
was the last thing that registered in his mind before he took off running as fast as he could down the corridor. Because he couldn't get much traction on the ice, he wasn't able to cover much ground. He moved into an alcove to catch his breath and drew the replica Glock from his pocket. He heard more muffled spits from a suppressed weapon, coupled with the tinkling of breaking ice as it shattered and hit the floor. When the noise stopped, it was replaced by a scratching noise that sounded like mice behind drywall. Now he knew how the shooter was able to move so fast. Crampons. The scratching sounds stopped only feet away from where Harvath now hid. There were two shooters, and they were listening for him. No one moved, and Harvath dared not even breathe. Then one of the shooters broke the silence.
"Links?"
he asked, German for left. His companion didn't answer. The man spoke again.
"Links? Rex? Was?" Left, right, what?
Obviously angry at his partner for talking, the other man heatedly admonished him with something that sounded like chew tea. It didn't sound like German, but Scott thought he recognized the word from somewhere. The first man now responded with what sounded like
ya baisse,
and the second man came right back with chew tea. Harvath now knew what he was hearing. During his travels on the ski team, he had made it his goal to learn specific phrases in as many different languages as possible. His favorites had been the ones for shut up and fuck you. It was juvenile, he knew, but people always said, in any language, you learn the bad words first. Besides, even if you knew nothing else, you could always get a guy laughing if you could say shut up and fuck you in his own language. The shut up and fuck you he was hearing now, chuti and yabese, were Serbian. Why were these men speaking German first and then swearing at each other in Serbian? Scott heard the resumed scrape of crampons along the ice. They were less than 3 feet from where he now stood. His hands tightened around the toy Glock. If one of them moved close enough, he could surprise him and press the pistol to his head while he ordered the other to drop his weapon. It might work. It would have to work. His ears strained, trying to judge how close they were now. Abruptly, they stopped again. They had heard something. Was it him? He hadn't even breathed and was beginning to get lightheaded from holding his breath. The men began backing away. It wasn't him. They had heard something else, but what? Maybe someone else was in the hallway. The men picked up speed, tracing back along the route they had come. Scott didn't waste any more time wondering why. He skidded out of the alcove and ran as fast as his shuffling feet would carry him in the other direction. Slipping, he cracked his knee against one of the steps carved out of the ice on his way to the elevator. He regained his footing and allowed himself to slide down the rest of the passageway. He pressed the call button, and after 2 seconds, decided it might not be such a good idea to hang around and wait. He turned to his left and ran down the hallway toward the restaurants and the exhibition hall, thankful to be off the ice. When he reached the other end of the corridor, another set of elevator doors was just closing, and he shoved his arm inside to stop them. They opened back up, and aside from a few startled tourists, it looked safe. Harvath rode down one level and exited. He sneaked into the Kino audiovisual show and took a seat off to the side, where it would be difficult to spot him. He glanced at his watch. The next train out wasn't for 40 minutes. Being careful that no one would see him transferring the Glock back to his waistband beneath his sweater, he took his jacket off, rolled it up, and placed it beneath his seat. He put his wool cap on again and pulled it down low. He also put on his wraparound sunglasses and slipped out of the Kino. In the hall, he checked both ways and then ran for the stairs. He descended 3 levels and walked quickly down another hall to the souvenir shop. There he bought a red Top of Europe windbreaker and a purple Jungfraujoch knit ski cap. Neither were his favorite colors, nor were they good for remaining inconspicuous, but he needed to change his appearance fast, and this was the best way to do it. The goods in hand, he climbed the stairs 1 level and ducked into a men's room. Picking an empty stall, he went in and locked the door. Scott took off the hat he was wearing and shoved it into his pocket. He put on the red windbreaker and purple hat and was about to unlatch the stall door when he heard someone enter the washroom. Quickly, he sat on the toilet and raised his legs off the floor. Withdrawing the Glock, he readied himself. The sound of heavy boots thudding along the floor echoed throughout the bathroom. A grunt was followed by someone farting, and then a chorus of laughter. Scott relaxed. These weren't his killers. Peering through the crack in the door to make sure the coast was clear, he flushed the toilet and exited the stall. The appearance of the young men at the urinal was pure snowboarder, and in Scott, they thought they saw a kindred spirit and nodded in his direction. He made small talk with them, and they told him that they had finished lunch and were headed back out. Scott joined them. Whoever was looking for him was looking for a lone male in different clothing, not the person he was now, and certainly not someone traveling with a group. Keeping his head down and laughing with the group, Harvath made his way to the glacier exit.
His new friends hopped on their boards, said goodbye, and shot off down the mountain. He was alone, and once again a target. The thing to do was to keep moving. As far as he knew, there were at least three people with guns who were after him. Standing in one spot for too long was not going to pay off. Timing how long it would take him to get back for the 1 o'clock train, Harvath struck off on the Glacier Trek Trail, praying he would figure a way out of all this. 54. Harvath walked as long as the cold and the time would allow. Although the idea crossed his mind, he knew he couldn't stay up here all night. He'd freeze to death. As he turned to walk back to the main complex, he was joined by one of the many groups of hikers who had passed him along the trail. A plan began to form in his mind. It wasn't a very good plan, but it was better than nothing. When he was shot at, it had been in a relatively deserted part of the Jungfraujoch. He had chosen the ice palace because he thought the tourists would give him good cover. With practically no one in sight, the men had fired indiscriminately, almost taking out their female partner, whom Scott had now come to accept was Aunt Jane herself. He had counted on the fact that whoever he was meeting wouldn't try anything stupid in a group of people. There was no reason to think that still didn't apply. With a 2.5-hour train ride back to Interlaken, there would probably be a lot of people catching the 1 o'clock. Whoever was looking for him would undoubtedly be at the station. But the longer he waited up here, the thinner the tourist crowd and his cover would get. Even if he was able to get on the train without incident, surely they were going to follow him. That hadn't been part of his original plan. He had expected to control the situation. At this point, though, that didn't matter. He would think of something. Blending in casually with a group of hikers, he asked them if they were on their way down. No luck. They were going in for lunch. Dejected, Scott scanned the entrance of the complex as they neared it, hoping to find three or more people he could blend in with. Up ahead, two families were readying their children, and Scott caught snatches of conversation that told him they were on their way down. Kids. The last thing he wanted was for any children to be hurt. He hung close enough to the family to blend in, but far enough to one side that if someone really wanted to take a shot at him, the children wouldn't be in the way. Subconsciously, Scott felt crosshairs pointing at him from every angle. He had a strange desire to rub his forehead and the base of his skull to somehow wipe them away. As he entered the Sphinx Hall, he heard the chime of the elevator and watched as a large group of tourists clambered out. They milled around and waited for the elevator to go back up and bring down the rest of their group. Scott abandoned his previous cover and waited with them. When they were joined by the second half, the group made their way to the train with Harvath nestled snugly in the middle. As they approached the tracks, he noticed several passengers had already boarded the train, and more still were standing on the platform, having a final cigarette. Harvath realized that the only person he would be able to ID was the woman. He had no idea what the two male shooters looked like, or if there were any others he hadn't seen. Toward the end of the platform, Scott noticed two solidly built men with wide frames who resembled a couple of bulldogs. His back tensed, but quickly relaxed again when the men were joined by their wives, who had gone back to the gift shop to buy one last thing. Harvath kept scanning the crowd as his group moved closer and closer to the train.
There, in the side passage. Those two fit the bill. Step a little farther into the light so I can see your eyes.
It was too late. Scott's group pushed onto the train, and he allowed himself to be swept along with them. So far, his new plan was working. No one had fired. As far as he knew, no one had even seen him, but that was a sucker's bet, and he didn't like the odds. He needed to assume that he had been spotted, and the gunmen were waiting for their exact moment to take their shot. It would happen quickly, and they would have to be close. Most likely, they would create a diversion to distract people's attention from what was really happening. The only insurance Scott Harvath had came from staying as close to this group as he could. He began committing each and every face to memory. In 19 minutes, they would be back at Kleine Scheidek, and he would have to change trains. At Kleine Scheidek, Harvath discovered he was lucky enough to be with another crowd of smokers. He'd never thought he would ever call being surrounded by smokers lucky, but today it was. The 19-minute no-smoking ride from the top of the Jungfrau had been more than they could bear, and as they crossed the platform to catch the next train, they all lit up, foregoing the gift shop. Harvath was able to stay right in the middle of them. Even though the transfer time was only 4 minutes, it was the longest 4 minutes of his life. He could feel the shooters close by. He knew they were waiting for their opportunity. Harvath's group was descending via Lauterbrunnen, and that was fine by him. Being such a large group, they had automatically accepted him as part of their tour. The bad hat and tacky windbreaker allowed him to fit right in. All he was missing was a camera. The train whistle blew, and the group boarded. This compartment was larger, and they had been joined by faces that Scott didn't recognize. But none had the eyes of a killer. Nevertheless, he had to expect that they had seen him, and that the attack would come at any time. If it did, what would he do? He had only his plastic Glock. He needed to be preemptive. There was only a half hour until the next stop, which was Vengen. That's where Scott would make his move. Another plan was beginning to form in his mind. 55. Half an hour gave Harvath plenty of time to become cozy with the members of the tour group sitting around him. A healthy dose of charm made him the darling of the conversation while the train slowly descended from the Jungfraujoch. As the overhead speaker began announcing the stop for Vengen, Scott could feel the train slowing down. Timing would be everything. He looked at his watch, and then out the window to judge how much distance was left.
"It'd be great to have you. We'll take you out on the boat and show you nothing but whales, seals, and beautiful Washington State scenery. Kamano Island is like no other vacation you've ever taken," Scott said, as he wrote down a fictional address with a pen he borrowed from one of the group members. On vacation, people were so willing to give strangers personal information that they never would at home, names, addresses, phone numbers. It was a phenomenon unique to traveling. As Scott was about to hand the ballpoint pen back to the man he'd borrowed it from, he made it appear as if he'd accidentally dropped it.
"What butterfingers I've got. Sorry about that," he said, bending down to pick it up.
The train came to a stop in the Vengen station, and Harvath kicked his plan into action. From where he was fishing beneath the seats for the dropped pen, he screamed,
"Oh my God! There's a bomb underneath the seats! Everybody out!"
A murmur of shock floated across the train compartment, but only a couple of people moved. He didn't have time for this. They were getting out whether they liked it or not. A little added influence was needed. Scott drew the fake Glock from his waistband and began yelling once again as he waved the pistol in the air where everyone could see it.
"A bomb! A bomb! A bomb! We're all going to die! Everybody get out! Run for your lives!"
Whether it was the added urgency in his voice or the gun, he would never know, but it didn't matter. Passengers were screaming and trampling each other to get out of the compartment and as far away from the train as possible. This only helped Harvath, as passengers began streaming out of the other compartments, shouting for help and running for their lives. It was sheer chaos. Using the fleeing passengers for concealment, Harvath hopped out of the train and began running with the herd's forward direction. Tentatively, he shot a glance backward, and his stomach immediately cramped at what he saw. 3 very large, broad-shouldered men standing alongside the train, scanning the crowd and not moving. Trouble in paradise. Harvath turned around, but not quickly enough to see that a woman in front of him had stumbled, and he fell right down on top of her. She was panicked, hyperventilating, and clawing at the snow-covered ground to get back up and away from the soon-to-be-exploding train. Next, a man ran straight over the top of Harvath, unknowingly digging the toe of his boot into the small of his back. Scott let out a groan of pain. Maybe his ruse had been a little too effective. Knowing he had to move fast, he saw a break in the people running to his right and rolled off the woman who was up and away in an instant. Scrambling to his feet, Harvath dug his boots in and shot forward out of his crouch. just in time to see two explosions in the snow where he had been lying. The killers had seen him too, and were now firing. Harvath took off as fast as his legs would carry him. There wasn't enough time to try to do another quick change to throw the men off his path. His only hope was to outrun them, or lose them somehow in the village. Vengen played host every year to the world's longest downhill ski race, the Lauberhorn. Although downhill had not been Scott's area of expertise, he had come to Vengen to see the race twice and cheer on the American team, as well as competitors he knew from other countries. The village hadn't changed much since he'd last been here. Completely devoid of cars, it seemed frozen in time. Were Goethe to come back and revisit the 900-foot-high Staubach waterfall, only the fashions would seem out of place. Harvath's breath came in quick, short gasps as he ran uphill deeper into the village. Dodging the brightly attired skiers that crowded the narrow lanes, he didn't dare venture a look back. He knew his pursuers were right on his tail. He took a quick right turn, and wood splintered as an ornate balustrade on a low-lying balcony exploded just above his head. Running hard, Harvath removed his purple cap and threw it to his left into a narrow alley between two chalets. He then dove right, behind a wall of hay stacked only a few feet high. Focusing on his breathing, he willed his body to calm down, or at least to quiet down. He strained his ears for sounds of the men coming down the small street. 15 feet in front of him, a herd of mountain goats, realizing Harvath was not here to distribute any of the hay he was hiding behind, went back to rubbing their heads against the rough posts of the tiny paddock, their bells ringing in a disjointed chorus. Scott continued to listen, and slowly he began to hear the telltale sounds of heavy boots crunching upon the snow. The shooters were close, but they weren't stupid. Taking their time, they moved cautiously down the street, ever watchful for an ambush. When they were almost even with the bales of hay, Harvath held his breath, his hands tight around the toy Glock for all the good it would do him. He heard one of the men speak. "Look, on the ground, 10 o'clock. That's the hat he was wearing. He went this way. We'll check it out. You go the other way and radio if you see anything. We don't want any more screw-ups. Get moving, and remember, he has a gun," said another voice. This one was obviously in charge. These men were speaking English, American English. They weren't the same voices he had heard in the Ice Palace. They were different, but the second man sounded familiar. He knew that voice. It was the same one Harvath had heard yell the word gun days before outside his bank. These were the men in the ghetto-mobile with the automatic weapons who had tried to kill him. What were they doing here? How could they possibly have followed him all this way? Harvath was sure that his trail stopped dead in Zurich, even if someone had been sharp enough to have been looking for Hans Brauner. Switzerland was a small country, but not that small. He couldn't figure out how in the world they had tracked him. He quickly did the math. The woman, and at least two men at the Ice Palace, and now these three here. What was the connection? Were they all working together? Were the woman and the two men from the Ice Palace also searching for him in the village? There wasn't any time to figure things out. He needed to get moving again. Peering over the bales of hay, he saw that two of the men had taken the bait and had headed off down the passage between the two chalets, back toward the village. The other man continued down the street in the direction his group had been heading before they split up. There was only one option open to Harvath, and that was to go through the paddock. It would allow him to put a lot of distance between him and his pursuers quickly, and that was all that mattered. Taking one more look over the bale of hay, he decided to make his move. Tucking the Glock back into his waistband, he covered the 15 feet to the paddock in seconds. In hindsight, he probably should have brought some of the hay with him. The minute he jumped into the enclosure, the animals started going crazy. The neighing and jangling of their bells grew as the animals converged on Harvath. Some of their horns were long and sharp, and undoubtedly could do a lot of damage. The goats didn't look happy, and Scott didn't want to hang around and see if they were friendly. This wasn't a day at the petting zoo. The animals converged on him almost at once as he tore across the territory they were so vigorously trying to defend. When he got to the far rail and placed his hands on top, ready to vault over, he felt something tear through the upper part of his left arm. He was sure one of the goats had gotten him with its horns, but looking back, he saw it wasn't that at all. The commotion from the goats had caught the attention of the lone shooter, who'd raced toward the paddock and was able to get off one silenced round before Scott got over the fence. It connected with Scott's arm, tearing through the windbreaker, as well as the clothes and flesh beneath. Harvath could already feel the warm spread of blood running down his arm. He didn't want to give the guy a chance at a second shot. With only his right arm for support, Harvath vaulted the fence and rolled when he hit the ground on the other side, wincing from the pain. He ran alongside a decaying shed that looked as if it were 300 years old, and then headed to where he could see crowds of people on a more populated thoroughfare. He heard the muffled spits being fired from behind as the bullets tore up everything around him. Scott ran faster. Hitting the thoroughfare, he ran across it and saw that he was parallel with a cafe that must have been popular with skiers, because there were rows and rows of skis and poles resting on racks outside. Quickly, he grabbed a pair that were entangled with ski poles and headed for an alley about 20 feet down. The alley actually passed beneath an old chalet, and therefore was relatively dark compared with the bright sunshine outside. As he hurriedly unlocked the skis, Scott glanced out the far end of the passageway and could see the peak of the Schilthorn off in the distance. His back flat up against the wall, he looked at his left arm and saw that it was completely covered in blood. The blood had even run down to his hand. There was nothing he could do about it now.
Bottom of the ninth, bases loaded.
Harvath wrapped both of his hands around one of the skis as tight as he could, the tip resting against the wall above his right shoulder. Time seemed to creep at a snail's pace.
Where is he? He had to have seen me come this way.
His left arm was killing him, and holding it in this position wasn't doing it any good. He didn't know how much longer he could keep it up. Then he heard footsteps from the other side of the wall.
Careful. Wait for it.
The gun preceded the shooter through the entrance to the passageway. Scott fought against every impulse in his body that told him to swing and run.
Wait, he told himself. Not yet.
Whoever the shooter was, he seemed to sense Harvath was near and chose his steps very carefully. It almost appeared as if he weren't moving at all, but he was. Scott could now see the hand, wrist, and forearm of the gunman.
Soon.
The upper arm appeared, then the shoulders, a torso.
Now!
Swinging with all of his might, Harvath nailed the gunman square in the chest with the ski, and the man went down, dropping his gun. He went for it, but Scott kicked him hard in the ribs. The man grunted, and instead of clutching his side where he'd been kicked, he rolled quickly to his right and grabbed for Scott's leg. The shooter brought his feet quickly around behind him, ready to jump up, and then there was a flash of something in the man's hand. A knife. That was the last straw. Harvath's anger raged. He didn't know what the hell was going on, but he'd had enough, and he certainly wasn't going to grapple with one bad arm and try to fight this guy for the knife. The man pointed his knife at Harvath.
You know what? I really, really don't like it when people point things at me, said Harvath.
The man froze for a moment, confused that Scott would address him rather than attack. But the confusion was only temporary.
If it's not a gun, then it's a knife. Here's the deal. I'm not playing around anymore.
Just as Scott finished, the man lunged and slashed at him with the blade. Harvath turned in time and grabbed one of the ski poles from where it rested against the wall. As the man attacked again, Scott faked left, then spun around hard to his right and plunged the pole deep into the man's chest. The knife fell from his hand, and in seconds, blood gurgled out of his mouth, painting his jacket a deep crimson.
It looks like you got my point, said Scott, as he let go of the pole.
The man, still on his knees, fell forward, but only a foot before the bottom of the pole hit the ground and he was propped up like a human pup tent. Not wasting a moment more, Harvath went for the man's pistol. A blanket of fire erupted in front of him as bullets ricocheted off the cobblestones of the passageway. The gunman must have radioed his position to his two colleagues.
There was no telling how far away they were. The bullets were close enough, and that was all that mattered. Harvath ducked and rolled toward the opposite entrance.